Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we're going to talk with Colonel John Eidsmo, whom I consider an old friend. He wrote a book many years ago, which is a classic book. Everybody should have this in their library. It's called Christianity and the Constitution. And John Eidsmo serves as the chief counsel of the Foundation for Moral Law. He has been a law professor. He may still do that in the spare time. He does a lot of things in his copious free time. But I've got to tell you this. Recently, I had the privilege of listening to several hours of lectures of John Eidsmo on CD. So they were audio lectures put together by Gary DeMar's group, American Vision. And it was all about the biblical basis of the Constitution. Required reading. I thought it was very informative. John, welcome back to the program.
Always good to be with you, Jerry. And I've benefited so much from the books that you have authored or co-authored, particularly George Washington's Sacred Fire, which is the best picture by far so that has been written in regard to the Christian beliefs of George Washington. And then the one that you more recently co-authored on Thomas Jefferson, which was so appropriately titled Doubting Thomas.
Yeah. Well, oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, where do I send the $20 bill? No, just kidding. All right. So morallaw.org for more information as far as your organization. But let's hone in on the Second Amendment. Guns. We don't talk about that very much on this program, but here as we record this right now in early January of 2016, the president is getting involved in some preparing some executive orders, which some people describe as essentially gun confiscation. I'm not sure how that's legal under the Second Amendment, but let's discuss this.
Well, as we know, President Obama supposedly taught constitutional law at an Illinois university before he became president. And I'm inclined to think he taught a course on how to avoid the Constitution, how to get around the Constitution, rather than how to follow it. Because we've seen presidents for quite some time that have been issuing executive orders. These have become much more prolific in more recent administrations. And there is a place for executive orders. I mean, the executive powers of the president have to be enforced by executive orders. However, when the president starts using those executive orders to deal in areas that are delegated by the Constitution to the legislative rather than the executive branch, that becomes a lot more dangerous. And that's been going on for some time now. But the latest twist on it, I would say, is where President Obama has, in many cases, just taunted Congress by saying, if you don't act on this, I will. In other words, here is a law that you as Congress should pass, obviously because the people in the Constitution have delegated the power over that field to Congress. Congress has chosen not to pass a law on the subject, meaning it's the will of Congress that we do not pass that law. And so Obama is just deliberately saying, I am going to get around you. I am going to usurp a power. If you don't do what I want you to do, I'm going to do it. Even though clearly the Constitution delegates the power to you, that is Congress. That's totally out of line.
Well, now the other side would say, Mr. Eidsmo or Colonel Eidsmo, look at the consequences. Look at all these this gun violence is out of control, all these mass shootings.
There certainly has been that, and that certainly is sad. But here's the point I would make on it. Every one of these mass shootings has taken place in a state where there were very strong gun control laws. In fact, the evidence, if you look to the statistics, John Lott, for example, of Yale University, in his book More Guns, Less Crime, demonstrates that the relationship between gun control and reduced crime is, in fact, the opposite. That states that have the freedom to possess arms, that you'll find less crime there than in states where guns are strictly regulated. And I just look at it this way. If I were planning to rob somebody's house, where would I go? Would I go to New York City, where probably very few people would have guns? Or would I go to a ranch out in Wyoming where they're likely armed to the teeth? I think the answer to that is pretty obvious, that we sometimes, I think, fail to consider just how many crimes are deterred by the fact that people have or may have guns.
That's a great point. I mean, it is just true that crime is terrible in Chicago, in New York City, and in Washington, D.C., and in all three of those cities, they have very strict gun control laws and have had that for a while. And who has the guns? The criminals.
That's the way it works. And, you know, I really think, too, a lot of this is to divert attention from what the real issues are. And when we look to these mass shootings that have been taking place, in a few cases bombings rather than shootings, but when we look at these, we find that in practically every one of them, as far as I know, every one of them actually, one of two things or both of two things are involved.
Craziness or Islam.
Extremist ideology,
yeah,
which in the vast majority of instances has been a form of Islam. The other is drugs, prescription drugs or non-prescription drugs, but put those things together, and that's where the problem is, and our administration today refuses to call a spade, and refuses to call an Islamic terrorist, and until we face that that is the problem, they're going to be lashing out at other things like this. I mean, plain fact of the matter is, probably most people who have been involved in the shootings that we're talking about here, how did they get to the site of the shooting? Probably by a car. So should we ban cars? Makes about as much sense.
All right, let me ask you a question. The whack job, for lack of a better term, that did some shootings in a Planned Parenthood outside of Colorado Springs. By the way, every Christian worth his salt or worth her salt, you know, denounced that, couldn't get to a microphone fast enough to say, you know, Christianity does not teach that, and it doesn't. But anyway, where was that guy coming from? Was he on drugs?
My understanding is that he was never involved, that we know of at least,
in a church,
any of the pro-life movement at all.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like he got his impetus from that, anything from the Right to Life people. But I would simply have to say there that if we're talking about a culture of death, Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry have in fact contributed a great deal to that culture of death. I mean, every abortion results in the death of an innocent human being.
Yeah.
And they are cheapening life by doing that. And so I think some of the blame needs to be right there.
And frankly, a lot of women are killed through botched abortions, safe, legal abortions, so-called, but they're not safe. And that happens a lot. And, you know, you see these statistics, that show that that's the case. Now, there was something you said, John Idesmo. Something you said in your series on the biblical basis for the Constitution, which I had never heard of. You said that there was a reunion about 15 years after World War II between American veterans and their former Japanese enemies. And the Japanese enemies said something fascinating related to this whole issue of gun control. Can you tell us about that story? It's fascinating,
yeah,
and not well known.
It was a friendly diplomatic meeting, and officers on both sides just wanted to exchange perceptions on what happened during the war and so on.
This was in 1961?
I believe that's correct.
Uh-huh.
I don't have that right before me, but at any rate, and during these exchanges, one of the American officers asked the Japanese officers why it is that they never attempted a land invasion of the United States. And the answer that one of the Japanese officers gave was that, well, we know that guns are widespread in America and that in many, many homes that people have private firearms, and we knew we'd be really setting into a minefield if we attempted a land invasion like that. Point of that is that the private possession of firearms does help to deter foreign aggressors as well as domestic aggressors. And that was one of the purposes, as a matter of fact. When you go back to the Federalist Papers and you read what Alexander Hamilton says and what James Madison says, both of them speak about one purpose of the right to bear arms, that being as a protection not just against foreign invasions, but also against domestic tyrants as well. And we need to understand that in those days it was thought that the military, that is, the army, at least, would primarily be composed of citizen militias, people that train by themselves, people that have their own arms, people that chose their own officers and go into battle as a unit from a locality. That was the understanding at the time. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I'm convinced the Second Amendment speaks about the right to keep and bear arms. It contemplates private ownership of firearms. You don't just go down to the armory and pick up your gun when you're called to duty. You keep and bear arms. But anyway, it demonstrates there that these are the purposes that the framers had in mind with the Second Amendment, and they are still valid purposes today. You know, you look back to something else, and that is concerning defense of yourself and your family from criminals. Back in those days, even towns usually didn't have that much of a police force, let alone a 911 where you could call them. And if you were subject to, let's say, an invasion of your house by enemies, by criminals, by hostiles, whatever it might be, you were pretty much on your own for a defense. And that's not entirely untrue today. The police, if you call the police because of a break-in in your home, they will get there in time to count the bodies and so on, but as far as to actually prevent the crime itself, very probably not.
Okay, what about a Christian ethic on this perspective in terms of we certainly don't want to perpetuate violence, certainly not in the name of Jesus?
I would argue that a strong defense deters aggression, and thereby it helps to preserve peace or secure peace. And I'd look to an Old Testament and a New Testament example. Going back to the Old Testament, I would look to Nehemiah chapter 4, where Nehemiah, and he says, and a few men with me. Now, I have to disagree with Ollie North here. Ollie North says it should say a few good men with me because they were Marines. Actually, they were Air Force. But anyway, but they went back to Jerusalem to rebuild Jerusalem's walls as a defense. As the enemies of Jerusalem decide that they're going to knock down this wall as it's being built, Nehemiah has good military intelligence. He learns of their plot. He puts his workers on active duty so that they are defending the walls when the crisis passes. He puts half of them on reserve duty to go back and keep building, and the others he keeps on duty to stand guard. And we read that the crisis passed without a shot being fired, arrow shots, that is, and without a drop of blood being shed, because Nehemiah was prepared. And Jesus may have been referring to that in the New Testament. He's certainly referring to the principle when he says, when a strong man armed keepeth his house, his goods are at peace. The idea, again, is that a strong defense deters aggression and thus helps to preserve peace. And I think that we have a duty, not only a duty to defend our nation and our community, but it's certainly a duty to defend our families as well.
Yeah. But what about the idea that it's just so excessive, all these guns and, you know, do we need multiple machine guns and, you know, all that kind of stuff? The kind of laws that people want to pass would seem to pass the common sense measure, right?
Well, there we get into the question, when we speak about the right to keep and bear arms, what is meant by arms? And obviously, I would say it does not include bombs or things like that. Whether it includes machine guns or things like that, that's a little more problematic. I would say probably not, but that might be an open question there.
Yeah.
And then we have the question, when it says, shall not be infringed, what is an infringement? Clearly, confiscation is an infringement. Is a waiting period an infringement? Is a tax an infringement? Is a registration requirement or a background check an infringement? Those are a little more difficult questions to answer. And I don't think we're saying here that we are going to close the door to any kind of regulation. But
right.
First of all, the regulation has to be shown to pass constitutional muster. And secondly, we need some evidence that this regulation is not going to simply make it more difficult for people to get guns. And third, we need some evidence that this is going to be effective in reducing crime or reducing terrorism.
All right, we have about half a minute left. What is the effect of President Obama's executive orders? What does he actually plan to do, to your knowledge?
Well, we'll probably know more of that after he meets with Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General. But essentially, one of the things he's talking about is requiring even part-time or gun show dealers to have background checks and the like. I don't think we can really say what the reaction to this should be until we know, but the biggest thing I think we need to notice is that he is apparently usurping a function that really belongs to Congress.
And
even if what he is doing is right, which I doubt very much that it is, but even if it is, that's not the office that should be doing it. This should be a decision by the elected representatives of the people in Congress.
Who are much closer to we, the people. John Eidsmo, thanks so much for being with us. Again, John Eidsmo from the Foundation for Moral Law, morallaw.org. Thank you, sir. God bless.
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay, bye-bye.